Sean, you're back. And I kind of feel like you're tagging me in because I'm heading to Vegas tomorrow morning. That'd be Thursday morning as we record this on Wednesday. I guess it's my turn, huh?
Yeah. Well, I hope you come back looking a little better than I did.
Well,
we got the 20 day. Well, I know you're a TV superstar, but got the 20 day beard going, the no haircut, looking sharp.
You know, they have razor blades and barbers in Las Vegas.
No, they don't.
Oh, okay. All right. You're right.
They're against the rules. Anything that distracts from gambling or eating or going out is banned, or hockey.
Fair enough. I'll agree with that. Sounds good. All right, dude. We have so much to talk about in this podcast. We're going to get to so much of the news and notes. You know, the Blackhawks winning the draft lottery. Connor Bedard likely going to the Blackhawks. The Rangers firing Gerard. Well, mutually parting ways, I should say, with Gerard Gallant. We're going to have Tripp Tracy on. He's going to talk Hurricanes with us. They're up 3-1 in their series against the New Jersey Devils. The playoffs, the second round has been wacky. But, Sean, we have to start. Now, things could change hours from now because we're recording this, like I said, Wednesday morning. The Toronto Maple Leafs and Florida Panthers play game 4 tonight in Florida. But the Maple Leafs, Sean, down 3-0 in this series, on the verge, unless they make history, of being knocked out. If they go out in 4, if they get swept, Sean, all the good vibes, everything that good about beating Tampa Bay in the first round, that gets wiped away. This is, you don't win one round and feel like you won it. I remember joking with Mike Zeisberg when we had him on that he'll be a part of the parade when they win the first round. Well, I mean, it did feel like they had a parade after winning the first round. Got to win 3 more, and they may not even win a game.
You know, you say if they get swept, I don't care if they get it to 7. If they lose, the path was right in front of them. They beat arguably the best team. Once the Bruins went out, that's break 1. Then they beat the best team left in the tournament on the eastern side, which is the Tampa Bay Lightning. Then they get what their fans are chanting for, which is the Florida Panthers. And I was going to be snarky and asked if you think they're still chanting for it, but they are. After game 3, they were still chanting. Granted, tongue in cheek, because they've gotten it handed to them after 3 games, but it's all there. The Colorado Avalanche have been knocked out on the other side. Like, if you were drawing up a roadmap of how do you end Toronto's futility in the Stanley Cup playoffs, it was all put in front of them. They choked it away.
Well, yes, but let's look at the other side here. The Florida Panthers are playing really good. They're playing really good hockey right now. And I understand
it. How many people thought the Florida Panthers were going to beat the Toronto Maple Leafs?
I'm raising my hand because I picked them. I picked them because I saw the way the Panthers were playing. The Panthers came back from 3-1 down against the Boston Bruins and won that series. And everybody talks about how the Bruins choked it away. And they did. They did because of the season they had. But can we give some love here? Can we give some respect to Paul Maurice's team and how they have been playing? They have been playing playoff hockey for a while now. Now, we can say they shouldn't, maybe they shouldn't even be in the playoffs, right? Had the Pittsburgh Penguins taken care of their business, Florida Panthers may not even be in the playoffs. That's break 1, right? We talk about the Boston Bruins losing for the Maple Leafs, right? Pittsburgh losing in the regular season. Break 1 for the Florida Panthers. They get in, they're down 3-1. Brad Marchand doesn't score on the breakaway in game 5 that would have won the series. That's break 2. And now they keep coming, and they're coming. And they are relentless in their attack. They are dominating the Toronto Maple Leafs top players. Toronto Maple Leafs top players, have they kind of wilted away and gone away in this series? Sure. Big reason, the Florida Panthers. Okay, so I get it. We look at it from a Toronto perspective because that's where the news is. That's where the pressure is. That's the story because that's the team that hasn't won the Stanley Cup in so long. That's the team that finally broke 19 years of futility in the playoffs, finally getting out of the first round, and maybe they get swept. So they are the story, but the Florida Panthers, those little Florida Panthers that nobody seems to pay much attention to, they're playing some really good hockey right now.
You want me to give credit to the Florida Panthers? There's been no bigger supporter than the Florida Panthers than me. Paul Maurice, Matthew Tkachuk, Montour, all those guys. Who's the better team?
On paper, the better team is the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Exactly. And they're down 3-0 and they
not by much. Not by much.
Can you look at the standings?
I do. Yes. And Florida had one of those weird seasons where they were taking, it took them longer than I thought a lot of people expect, than anybody of us expected them to finally figure it out. New style of play, different type of coach, different way of looking at things, playing harder. We talked to Maurice about all that. It took them longer. The Maple Leafs were more ready set, ready made. They did it. They did what they were supposed to be doing in the regular season. But if you look at the team, Sean, the Maple Leafs, when Bobrovsky's going, they don't have the better goalie. Look at their defense. It's not better than the Florida Panthers defense. Nobody's talking about a guy like Gustav Forsling, who's really good. He's a really good player. But, you know, we tend to harp on the Maple Leafs and what they're doing. And look at them. The Panthers defense is arguably better. Forwards, I mean, look, Barkov, really good. Kachuk, terrific. I give you the forwards, the top end forwards for the Maple Leafs should be better than the top end forwards for the Florida Panthers. But you got guys like Carter Verhaeghe who's scoring big goals. Matthew Tkachuk who's playing a big role, right? Barkov doing what he does. Duclair doing what he does. And yes, that's the biggest thing here when guys like Nylander. And well, I don't even want to harp on Nylander because I don't even think he's been that bad in this series. But Marner and Matthews and Tavares, when they go away, the Leafs go away.
Yeah, so because they're the better team, they failed. Let's give Florida all the credit we want to give. And look, the series isn't over. There's one or two teams that have come back from 3-0 down.
Yeah.
For us to come back next week and still be talking about the Toronto Maple Leafs being in the playoffs would be a shocking development. If we don't talk about them, it isn't what Florida did. As great as what Florida did is, it's what Toronto didn't do. And there can be no peace in the valley when it's over. The second round, that's good enough for this organization. That's good enough for Toronto. I don't think so. And look, we talk about windows all the time. It's on its way, right? Like it's either going to open for another year or it's on its way down, depending on what they do coming out of here.
What happens if they do get swept or lose in five, right?
Why do you keep saying numbers?
If they come back to force a game seven in this series, that shows me something about where the Toronto Maple Leafs are. Is it good enough? No, it's not good enough. They shouldn't have lost the first three games. They've got to take at least one of them. I get that. But if they come back and force a game seven, the narrative does, you have to admit, Sean, the narrative does change a little bit if they force a game seven being down 3-0.
What does it change? They lost.
Fair. Well, that's if they lose game seven, you know, if they get there and lose game seven.
Well, but that's what we're talking about. We're right. Talking about another early spring in the capital of hockey.
Okay, then let me ask you this. Does your feeling on what happens with the Maple Leafs future, the future of Kyle Dubas, the future of Sheldon Keefe, the future of this core, does it change? Does your feeling on what happens with them change if they come back and force a game seven versus if they get swept?
Nope.
So what happens in your mind?
I don't know, but it doesn't change by what they do now. They've put themselves in this predicament. Who cares if you decide at 3-0 down that you're going to play hard and you're going to win? And does the fact that the Bruins got to a game seven make them feel any better that they lost? No.
But they also were up 3-1.
I understand, but the number doesn't matter. When you lose, you lose.
All right. Fair. And it isn't. If they get
like
swept,
it would almost make me feel worse if they got to a game seven. If I was part of that team or I was a fan of that team, if they got to a game seven and lost, I'd be like, are you kidding me? Can you figure out a worse way to break my heart?
Well, that's true. That would be the Toronto Maple Leafs way, figuring out worse ways each year to break your heart. and going down 3-0 and coming back to force a game seven, that would do the trick. There's no, that'd be different than what they've done in previous years. There's no question about that. Look,
and maybe they do it because they broke the curse.
You know,
maybe this is all just a precursor to even greater heights.
You know, what's interesting is I've heard this narrative, Sean, that like, you know, there's no pressure on Toronto right now. No one expects them to win. There's always pressure on the Toronto Maple Leafs. Right. There's always pressure on the Maple Leafs. Always pressure on the Maple Leafs. If they go down in flames and lose in four, they're going to feel it all off season. It's going to be talked about all throughout the regular season next year until they get back to the playoffs. And then it'll still be talked about in the playoffs next year if they get back there. If they lose in five, same. They lose in six, same. To your point, Sean, if they lose in seven, same. Okay? So the pressure is always going to be more on the Toronto Maple Leafs. The Florida Panthers are the team that can play freer now. They got a 3-0 lead in this series. They're feeling great, right? They drop one. We're okay. We beat them three times in a row. We're feeling pretty good. Now, that is also, you ask, you know, players who were part of, say, that 2010 series between Boston and Philly. And I spoke with Mark Recchi for our coach's room story. And I know Mike Zeisberger spoke to Brian Boucher. You know, both sides of that series, Recchi with the Bruins, Boucher with the Flyers. And the feeling was that, you know, the Flyers in game four just felt they needed to get one. The Bruins in game four were worried after they lost it that they might have given the Flyers life. So there is that. But the pressure is always going to be on the Toronto Maple Leafs. And that's why it will remain on them, whether they, you know, unless they come back and make history here, they're going to be feeling this all off season. I agree to your point. Even if they lose in seven, you know, they'll be feeling this all off season, all regular season next year. And then if they get back to the playoffs, because it's no gimme to get back to the playoffs.
You know what? We'll play this in a week and we'll look stupid. Just like you looked a little stupid, Dan. I think we found a team that's as fast as the New Jersey Devils.
Yeah. When the Devils slow down, that's for sure. Yeah.
Oh, so now who's not giving?
No. The Carolina Hurricanes are taking it to the Devils. There is absolutely no question about it. Games one and two.
They might be faster, right?
When Carolina turns it on and they play their style, they play faster. They move the puck faster. The Devils are, to me, the fastest team. Like skating wise, they are the fastest team. Transition wise, they're the fastest team. But the thing with Carolina, in the three games that they've won in this series, and we'll talk to Tripp Tracy about this when he comes on with us, the three games that they've won in this series, they've been all over the Devils. They've been on top of the Devils. They've given the Devils absolutely no room to even create their speed. The one game that the Devils won, the Devils were able to turn it around and get that game going, and it forced Carolina to back away a little bit. But Carolina has done what it does. I mean, look, Rod Brendamore is having maybe the best playoffs of any coach. We could talk about Paul Maurice. We could talk about Dave Haxtell. A lot of guys, Bruce Cassidy, are having really good playoffs as coaches. But considering the losses that they've had, the player losses that they've had, Svechnikov, Tara Vinen, and you got to throw Max Pacioretty in that mix. And this is already a team that was without a superstar scorer, a go-to scorer, if you will. What he's been able to do in these playoffs, again, you know, getting enough offense against a team that doesn't give up much in the New York Islanders and turning around and taking the Devils right out of the game that they love to play in three out of the four times in this series so far. It's been masterful by Rod Brendamore.
So, Dan, I could tell you all the reasons why you were wrong about Carolina, but we'll leave that to Tripp Tracy in a little bit. Now we'll go to Edmonton and Vegas. But all year long, I made an argument that Connor McDavid might not be the MVP of the league. And all year long, you laughed at me. Ha ha, how could you say that? He's the best player in the league, blah, 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 blah. So after game three, Connor McDavid, the MVP of the league, comes out and says that Leon Draisaitl, he's a pretty good player. You know what? On a lot of nights, he's the best player in the world. Whoops.
On a lot of nights. Not every night.
A lot of nights is actually more than half.
Connor McDavid is going to tell you he's the best player in the world?
A lot of nights is more than half.
Again, I stress to you, first off, that was after game two. Game three, they get smoked. But you think Connor McDavid's going to come out and say that Leon Draisaitl is a really good player? On some nights, he's the best player in the world. On all the other nights, it's me. He's not going to say that. Of course, no. He's going to pump up his teammate. And Leon Draisaitl is playing right now in the playoffs like the best player. He's been the best player in the playoffs. He's been the most prolific scorer in the playoffs. Easy. No question about it. But through the course of time, through the course of this past several seasons, playoffs last year, it's been Connor McDavid. And it's not like Connor McDavid is that far off from where Leon Draisaitl is right now either. So let's not forget that. Draisaitl is playing. He's taken his game, which is already one of the top five games in the league, to another level in the playoffs. And he deserves all kinds of credit for that. Evgeny Malkin has done that before too, Sean. He's done that with Sidney Crosby on his team. We never, ever, ever said that Malkin was the best player in the world over Sidney Crosby, even when he did it.
Well, I don't think Sidney Crosby said Malkin was the best player in the world either. When the arguably the best player in the world says somebody else is the best player in the world, that opens the door to that other guy being the best player in the world.
Sure does.
And right now, and during huge parts of this year, I would argue that Leon Draisaitl was the most valuable player on his team. Part of my argument that Connor couldn't be the MVP of the league was there were days when he wasn't the MVP of his team. When you talk about 200-foot games, Leon Draisaitl's better.
I mean, we're talking about, we're arguing about two guys who are going to go down as legends in this league, okay? But I disagree with you in terms of the 200-foot game. I really do. I think nobody covers the 200 feet of the ice better, to be honest with you, than Connor McDavid. But look, you're fair to bring it up. I'll take it right now because Leon Draisaitl is playing like the best player in the world right now. He is. Right now, he is playing like the best player in the world, and you need that, and that's a... You know, but Edmonton needs more, right? I mean, Edmonton needs a little bit more here. They're down as we talk right now. They play tonight. They're down 2-1 in this series. And we've seen them down 2-1 in a series. They were down last series, 2-1 against the Los Angeles Kings. So they're certainly not near as cooked as the Toronto Maple Leafs or the New Jersey Devils look right now. I'll give it to you. I'll back away for right now because you wanted to, go there with the Draisaitl. So I'll back away right now.
I didn't go there. Connor went there. But you're right. They do need more. And look, I think it's going to be a long series. I think you're going to spend a little bit of time in Vegas. Fortunately for you, you'll get a few good meals. You'll have a good time with Derek.
Don't forget my trip to Edmonton for game six.
Yeah, well, that too. But I think this is a long series. Look, Vegas has done some really good things. We talked about Bruce Cassidy and the fact that he's had a really good playoffs. And I think that's true, bringing in Carrier when he was healthy and scratching Phil Kessel was a big move, right?
Yeah.
Like, and some of the other things he did. Look, they're in a little bit of trouble now. If Laurent Brossoit is hurt as he looked, that could change the series. But Edmonton hasn't gotten great goaltending, and right, they've got no depth scoring at all. It's three guys. It's McDavid, it's Draisaitl, and it's Bouchard, who is just a menace from the point with his shot and on the power play. And almost all his points have come on the power play. You look at game three, and Vegas finally figured it out, and they didn't take the bait, and they didn't go to the penalty box, and Edmonton didn't score on the power play. And they were a different team. 5-on-5, this is not a competitive series.
Mm-hmm. Did Vegas not take the bait, or did Edmonton not force them into penalties the way Edmonton can force you into penalties? And we know that they can continue to. They may do that in game four, right? They may do that going forward. They did it against LA, right? I mean, they that's as the series go on, they McDavid and Draisaitl, these guys force you into the penalties. So I wonder if that was just an off night for Edmonton. And to be honest, we should get to Trip Tracy here, but what's interesting is a lot of teams are having off nights in the second round. There's, as we talk right now, there's been 14 games played in the second round of the playoffs. 8 of them have been decided by 3 or more goals. All 4 games in the Carolina New Jersey series have been decided that way, by 3 or more goals, by 4 or more goals, really. It's weird. It's odd, but goal scoring is up in the playoffs. It's at a level we haven't seen in, I think it's 30 years since we've seen the goal scoring be at where it is. It's almost 6.5 goals per game. And you look at Seattle, Dallas, they're over 8 per game. Carolina, New Jersey is at 8 per game. Hurricanes have 21 goals. And Vegas, Edmonton's at over 7 per game in their series. The one that's actually lower scoring and tighter games is actually the series that could end the first series that could end, which is Florida Toronto. So it's been a wackier second round, for that matter. You've seen, like, Edmonton had an off night, I think, in game three. I think just had an off night. Vegas was really good, but Edmonton had an off night.
Yeah, no, I agree. And like I said, I think this series is going a long time, just because I don't know that either team can shut it down with the goaltending that they have right now. So, but, and we do need to talk about Dallas and and Seattle and the story that's being orthed out there. It might be the most competitive of all the series. But what we should do is we should get to Trip Tracy because he was really good on Carolina. And then when we come out, we'll talk the final series. And then we got a lot of other news to get to, like you mentioned at the top of the show. Changes with your New York Rangers.
My New York Rangers? Slow down.
Well, that's who you cover.
They're not mine. I cover all 32 teams.
I know, and you love them all equally. Like
that's right.
That's what I tell people. But draft lottery, Connor Bedard, all of that. We'll get to all that, but let's get to Trip Tracy right now because, A, it's Trip Tracy, and, B, he was on top of his game talking about the Carolina Hurricanes and the series itself with some really good comments about Jack Hughes, so stay to the end.
Trip, thanks so much for jumping on with us. So there's a lot to talk about with this Hurricanes-Devils series, but I wanted to start with the amount of goals we're seeing scored in this series. 32 goals in four games between these two teams. Does that surprise you?
Yeah, Dan, first of all, great to be with you and Sean. Thanks for having me. It does to some degree because, you know, the Hurricanes – I mean, they have more organizational depth than they've ever had. But when sequentially, you know, you lose Pacioretty, a natural goal scorer, Andrei Svechnikov, an all-star, and then Teuvo Teravainen in the first round, and you've gotten this type of production, on top of the fact that the power play was difference-making, the penalty kill has been Carolina's first star among the star-like contributions to get them one win from the conference final. But the power play has been just okay. I'd say mediocre in this series. And so when you factor in, you're missing those three guys, which would be a load and a huge bit of adversity to overcome for any team. And then that you're not clicking with regularity on the power play to get this type of contribution across the board has, yes, been a very, very pleasant surprise.
But you have Jordan Martinuk, so it doesn't matter. I mean, in all seriousness, it must be nice to see a player who has kind of been the hidden face of the franchise for a long time when other guys have stepped to the forefront, but clearly in that room been an important part of this franchise for the better part of several years to finally kind of step into the spotlight and be able to show not only his skill, but his personality.
You know, Sean, I'm going to back it way up to it was the playoffs of 2018, I believe, that, you know, the Hurricanes were at the end of the 10-year stretch without making the playoffs. And a lot of people didn't think, you know, you guys are gurus, so you would know. But a lot of people didn't think that, you know, because you don't see it very often, that you can make a trade during the playoffs. And that's when Don Waddell acquired Jordan Martinuk. He was coming back from the gym in Arizona. And since then, you know, he's had some terrific stretches with the Hurricanes. He's a heart and soul guy on the team, but he hasn't been healthy for the most part in the playoffs. And he's been healthy all year. And early in the season with the departure of Nino Niederreiter, he was given an opportunity and a massive responsibility to play on the left side, a line that was so good last year, where Niederreiter had been with Jordan Staal in the middle and Jesper Foss on the right. I know he's not there now. He's been playing with Kotkaniemi and Jesper Foss. But the fact that, A, he's healthy, the fact that when the physicality, fighting for every inch, ramps up to the nth degree in the playoffs, I mean, he gives you that in spades. He's always been able to shoot the puck. But, Sean, the big thing for me is this, and I spoke about it on our telecast throughout the regular season, Nino Niederreiter was a great Hurricane. It was a challenge for him when the pace of play ramped up, you know, to be able to do the things. And he did it in different spots in the postseason. But Jordan Martinuk can move. When he's healthy, he can play with tremendous pace, aside from a guy that is a playoff-made individual. So I actually, after the win last night in New Jersey, he plays cards, one of the two card tables, and I spent some time with him. We have a close personal relationship aside from the professional relationship. And I said, you know, this really is not maybe the extent of the numbers that he's had in this series against the Devils. Yes, but it's really not altogether a surprise for me because of those ingredients. And you can't be physical. You can't get to the hard areas and be effective if you can't skate. And when he's healthy, he can skate.
Yeah, and I wrote last night in my story, I wrote about him. I said he's kind of the perfect picture of what the Carolina Hurricanes are. You know, the tenacious, energetic, you know, in your face, on top of you, yet, you know, fast. And I think, Tripp, what you're talking about here is essential in this series in particular, because we know if the Hurricanes get caught in quicksand, well, the Devils are going to ram it right down their throats, and that's their game. But it seems like with Martinuk and the way he's moving, you know, in these games that they're winning, especially, and it was never more evident, I don't think, than game four last night, he's shoving the Devils. He's shoving his speed back in the Devils' face, and that's making them slow down and then making them look in quicksand. You agree with that?
I do agree with it, and it's fitting. I mean, your producer and guru, Bob Bender, he probably will be able to get this out, but, you know, above me, there's some type of construction going on, and that's fitting for Jordan Martinuk, by the way. and he does represent all of that you mentioned, Dan. And the other thing that he mentions is that he's been around for all five of these playoff runs. And yes, you've added some tremendous veterans. I mean, Brent Burns has had a game-changing year for Carolina on and off the ice. You know, when Carolina won the Cup in 2006, I remember it distinctly. You had a bunch of veterans that had come close, but the Stanley Cup had proven to be very, very elusive. Too many for me to name right now. And I thought that was a big part of Carolina winning for Jordan. But there's also this core group that has learned some hard, hard, painful lessons in these playoff experiences. And I think the maturity of that group is really showing so far in the first two rounds. And I think it's going to be a necessity if they're going to make it a short series tomorrow night against the Devils. So I think about that without question with Jordan Martinuk. And the other thing I think about with him being able to produce on the road, getting back here, Rod with last change against Lindy tomorrow night. I thought Rod did a heck of a job in games one and two, because Martinuk, along with Kokaniemi and Foss, they played against Dougie Hamilton, who's enjoyed a fabulous regular season. But I thought that was a really good usage of last change in games one and two, because Jordan Martinuk, he lost some big-time heaviness in Svechnikov. Patch Reddy was playing with an edge when he was in the lineup. And I thought he really got in on the body and forced Dougie Hamilton in games one and two to get rid of pucks prematurely. And then you're dealing from a position of strength, because Carolina can transition the puck, and Martinuk has scored some beautiful transition goals in this series. But their bread and butter is establishing that puck pursuit and their forecheck that originates on the goal line. Nobody does a better job than Jordan.
You spoke a lot about some of the injuries to veteran guys, and then about this core that has been together for a long time and suffered some horrible defeats and some really devastating times. But there's a player on this team, and I was shocked when I looked it up. I was actually looking up to see the defenseman's time on ice. The leading forward time on ice is a young man named Seth Jarvis. He's tied with Sebastian. They're both at a little over 18 minutes, but Seth is not part of any of that. He's new blood. We saw a little bit of his specialness at the outdoor game, which seems like it was 14 years ago, even though we saw you a couple of months ago. But to me, this has been an unbelievable showcase of kind of a hidden gem that's sitting down there in Raleigh.
I totally agree. And I mean, you back it up to last year. Here's a guy that because of the competitive depth driven nature of the Hurricanes, you know, they did not have him even penciled penned in to make the team as a rookie, and he made the decision for him. So that's what gets him into the NHL last year as a rookie. But that is not atypical for countless young talented players. The beginning of this season was a very, very tough go. And I remember in November doing an interview with Seth in Winnipeg, where he's from, before a game against the Jets. And he was very candid and said, this is a hard league and I'm learning it right now. And then he was able to crash through the wall. Then when you mentioned the stadium series, they had a hat trick the night before, a home game on Cam Ward Hall of Fame night, was really good in the stadium series. Then he hit a wall again. And it tells you a lot about the depth of his self-belief that he's been able to fight through it. It tells you about you know, Rod Brindamore, who I think is having a magical run in his decision-making in the playoffs as the head coach, and empowering players. He's accountable, but he always delivers his candid messages in a very positive, confidence-building way. And then I mentioned Brent Burns a minute ago. Brent Burns, in particular, with a guy like Seth Jarvis, he knows how to manufacture confidence with some of his younger teammates in a priceless fashion when it's needed most. And so I think about all those factors. And then the other thing I think about when I think about Rod, I wish that we had a GoPro on, because Rod and I went on the PATH train from Jersey City to New York on Monday afternoon to see two of his kids in New York City, and him and I trying to navigate our way on the PATH. Not a hard thing to do, but Rod and I made it hard. And, you know, Rod was talking about his game plan for last night. And, you know, one of the things he mentioned, he says, Tripp, Seth Jarvis is really going right now. Lindy has really done a nice job in game three of using his last change. And he was thinking about, you know, do I double shift Seth Jarvis a little bit on the fourth line? Then he said, you know, he's earned it. I'm using him on the power play. I'm using him on the penalty kill. And is that going to be too much of a load for him? But the fact that Rod entertained that thought just tells you about what an impact player Seth has been here in the postseason and a big part of Carolina's success.
He's a fun little player to watch. There's no question about that. Tripp, you and I were talking the practice day, so Monday, before you went on the PATH train and maybe got lost, about the goaltending situation for the Hurricanes. Mm-hmm. And we were wondering, you know, if Antti Raanta was ready to go, which it turns out he was not. But if he was, would it be the best move to put him in? Because worst case, you're 2-2 going back to Raleigh, and you can go back to Freddie Anderson if you need. Or you go up 3-1 and Ranta's in net and he takes over for a little bit. But Freddie comes in and they were so good in the second period, so it's hard to say this, but I don't know if they're in the game in the first period without Freddie Anderson, right?
I totally agree, Dan. And again, I keep coming back to this PATH ride, and Antti wasn't ready to go. But Rod said to me, he goes, and you know, you and I were sitting right next to each other in practice. I was watching Raanta closely, but I was watching Anderson too. And Freddie made an impression with Rod in practice on Monday. He said he looked like he really wanted it. Mm. And, you know, Rod said that, and now this famous subway ride. And, you know, and he had some gumption in practice. And in the first period, if New Jersey extends the lead to 2-0, I think we're talking about a 2-2 series because the Hurricanes couldn't have liked the way they played in the first period. They had to love the outcome. And when they got the late goal, that Slavin really triggered that Martinuk to Natchez to tie it. I think that was the biggest goal of the hockey game. But Freddie made two or three, maybe even four outstanding saves after Jack Hughes made it 1-0. Those are the saves you've got to have. And big bounce back game for him. But I think it goes back to that practice where you and I were sitting, you know, a couple of seats from one another. And again, Rod, you know, he's got so many things to focus on, but I know Freddie's practice made a very positive impression on his head coach. His father, Ernst, was there last night, very Danish name, watching Freddie. And it was a very timely performance. He didn't have to do much after the first period, but he was a huge reason that it was 1-1 after 20.
Yep, I've lived here now for 23 years. I still get lost on the PATH train. Don't worry about it.
That makes me feel better.
It is one of the most confusing pieces of mass transit that ever existed.
Yeah, I will tell you, on the way back after we had an early dinner, and then when I say early, Rod's dinners are usually at 6. This one was at 4 p.m. And so we're going back. We're having trouble with our tickets, and classic. And so then Rod takes a chance on the PATH going back because we're staying in Jersey City. He goes, my gut tells me this Hoboken train is stopping in Jersey City. I said, okay, Rod, follow your gut. It didn't. And I said, but then we were talking about some things on the train. And I said, well, Rod, your bad gut decision is now in the rearview mirror. Now follow your gut for tomorrow night.
Well, and you actually led right into what I was going to say, like him trying to navigate the path system might be the only problem he's had so far this postseason. You know, we've talked about magical touches that coaches are having. I think Bruce Cassidy's had some in Vegas for sure. And clearly Paul Maurice has, but I don't know if there's a guy who's made more right decisions in the first two rounds of the playoffs. You talked a little bit about line matching. He's had to make some goalie decisions. He's had to make some lineup decisions, and it seems almost everything turns out perfect.
Yeah, I agree with you, Sean. Just, I guess, continuing with the goaltending theme, you know, that I had some very credential players around the league reach out when we were on the plane up to game six against the Islanders. And they're like, who do you think Rod's going with in game six? It had been all Raanta. And I said, I think he's going Anderson. I'm not sure. But, you know, these Stanley Cup champion players, I mean, after the fact, they actually said he's got big kahunas. And, you know, but then I said to Rod, because he's so humble about it, I said, after Freddie kept it at one, Cal Clutterbuck scored early in that game six, and your penalty kill keeps you in the game, and eventually you turn it in your favor in the third period. Aho ties it up in Paul Stastny in overtime. So I told Rod the next day what a couple of these guys around the league had said, captains. And he said, that was an easy decision. The tough decision would have been, had we lost that 1-0 in regulation, what would I have done in game seven? Well, I thought that he had set the stage perfectly. They were a two-goalie or even a three-goalie team with success all year when you factor in Pyotr Kochetkov. And I don't think you have to change your mindset just because it is the playoffs. I do think this is now Freddie's series for sure. It's not to say that Raanta couldn't become a part again. Who knows, even Kochetkov. But he has managed his goaltenders perfectly. He delegates to his assistant coaches. And in this case, the goalie coach, Paul Schoenfelder, Sean, he makes the last decision. But when he delegates, he doesn't delegate and then usurp. He delegates and empowers. And I think that's a really important part of his success. He's had to move his pieces around up front with those three guys that haven't been available. And I think he's done it brilliantly. You know, last thing he'd ever want to do is break up that line that is such a central straw to the Carolina drink, and that being Staal with Martinook and Fast. But he felt it based upon necessity. He knew he needed to get Natchez going last night. I know he was flirting with the idea of moving Natchez around because Lindy was using his fourth line that's been outstanding and has played a heavy game against Jordan Staal at home. And he followed his gut. He kept Natchez with Staal and Jack Drury, and Natchez delivered the goods last night. So it's not just been the decisions and adjustments he has made. It's been the ones that he's contemplated but hasn't made. When he's inserted Mackenzie McEachern, small thing, but in the lineup in both series, in particular game four against the Islanders, was very, very significant. And I'm not even touching his ability to inspire. I don't think there's anybody that matches that, even with the other outstanding coaches that are currently in the playoffs in the league.
Last one for me, and this might go to Rod as well, but it's the home record that this team has. So they're going home for game five and they can win it and go to the Eastern Conference final. They lost one home game in the playoffs last year, and that was obviously game seven against the Rangers. They've lost one home game this year. The road teams have been so good in the playoffs of late, yet the Carolina Hurricanes don't seem to lose very much on home ice. Why is that? Why are they? Is it the matchups? What is the reason behind their success at home at a time when home ice advantage doesn't seem to matter as much anymore?
I think that, yes, the matchups do play a significant part. We've touched on a few that they didn't have in New Jersey that I think were very pivotal in games one and two, and Rod will have that autonomy with last change tomorrow night. I think the fan base is central in this. I really do. I was just calling these games on radio with Mike Maniscalco, but before game three, I was on press row and I was talking to Scotty Bowman, and he goes, and he coached in Carolina and beat Carolina in the 2002 Stanley Cup final for Detroit. And he's Tripp, this building on television is ridiculous. It's the loudest building I've heard. This is Scotty talking, mm-hmm. And he's talking about when he coached in St. Louis, he's such a genius, but he was telling me about, St. Louis was the first building to use music in the building. And that was a game changer. And he beckoned back to those days. And I do think that the crowd is a very significant factor, especially with the fact over the years, you know, the 10 years without the playoffs, the Hurricanes were nowhere near as talented as they are now, but they were also a reactive team in their own building. They weren't a proactive team. I think they have, it's not going to happen every night because they're two teams that are trying to start well. But for the most part, they have made a habit of getting to their game quickly and early. And I look back to game five against the Islanders. If you guys told me right now, Tripp, take that effort up 3-1 in that series and live with the outcome tomorrow night, I would take it and run for the hills. The Islanders won that game. You couldn't get a bounce. The Islanders were opportunistic. There is a huge, invaluable carrot for the Hurricanes in winning this series tomorrow night. Yes, how quickly a series can change on a dime against a very, very good team in the New Jersey Devils. But I happen to believe if you're going to win the Stanley Cup, you need a short series somewhere in there. It was against the New Jersey Devils in 2006 in the second round that the Hurricanes got a split on the road after winning the first two games at home and ended it in five. And that was their one short series. New Jersey, it's going to be the hardest game to win. And this is a very proud team and a very, very talented team. So you're going to get their best tomorrow night. But I think the maturity of this group, fueled by their fan base, to your question, Dan, I think is a big part of it, along with the matchups. And I think, you know, they've gotten better on the road this year. The regular season gave me a lot of hope that they wouldn't be so drastic in their home success versus road woes like they were in the playoffs last year. They won 2 out of 3 in the Islander series, and now they got a split in New Jersey. The maturity of the group and recognizing the value of this opportunity tomorrow night, I think that they are going to give themselves every chance to end this thing, but they're going to have to earn it.
Tripp, and one quick last one for me. You get to see a lot of players, obviously, aside from the Hurricanes and calling all the games. Just curious your impressions of Jack Hughes.
Oh, swagger, it factor. Everybody, Sean, thinks about, as well we should, about his game-changing speed. In terms of the guys I saw in the regular season, probably only second fiddle to Connor McDavid from that standpoint, but he has that it factor. You know, in speaking to him, I love the genuine content of what he says. He walked in the building with his brother, Luke, before game three, and Rod and I actually went to go a year ago, March. We were in Washington. We went to go see his son, Skyler, in Quinnipiac. Skyler won a national championship with Quinnipiac this year. We went to Allentown to watch Skyler play Michigan. And Jack Hughes was on that team. Beniers was on that team. Owen Power was on that team. First time I'd seen Luke Hughes play in person. I turned to Rod in the second period. I said, who is this Luke Hughes? He's the best player on the ice. And so then Luke and Jack were walking in, and I shared that story with him, you know, before game three. I think that he's already a superstar in the National Hockey League. My hope is that, you know, just like Carolina's outstanding core has had to learn some hard but very positive lessons, that the maturity of Carolina's group is going to lend towards that. But against Jack Hughes, who I could not be more impressed with, they're going to have to earn it. I do think that the Hurricanes, for the most part, with their elite defense, Sean, have done a very good job minimizing him for good portions of the series. I with those injuries up front, I knew that Carolina's defense, from top to bottom, the big boys in Slavin and Burns, Pesci and Shea, huge bounce back night last night. It's the most confident I've been in their third pairing in my time with Chatfield and Gauss to spare. I think they've really done a sensational job with the identity of the back pressure, the forwards, of limiting Jack Hughes. But you can't take a breath with regards to that. I think Slavin in particular has had an absolutely monstrous, consistent defensive playoff so far. I think he's been the best defensive defenseman in the NHL playoffs. Here we are in the second half, the second round.
Tripp, you're the best. Thanks so much for joining us. Keep up the great work, all right?
Thanks, boys. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Great stuff there from Tripp Tracy. Again, Carolina can close out the New Jersey Devils Thursday night at PNC Arena in Raleigh. They keep playing the way they did in game four, and especially in games one and two as well. They will close out the Devils because they are pushing like an experienced playoff team, Sean. But hey, there's another, and you mentioned it before we went to Tracy. There is a real competitive series going on between the Dallas Stars and Seattle Kraken. 5-4 in overtime Seattle in game one. 4-2 Dallas in game two. 7-2 Seattle in game three, controlled that game. And then 6-3 Dallas in game four, and the two goals in the third period for the Kraken made it look closer than it really was in that game. So it's been up and down for both teams. Neither team has managed to win back-to-back games yet in the series. The series is 33 goals. It's 8.25 goals per game in this series. The goaltending has been not great, but that it has made for some pretty entertaining hockey. And, you know, I think of this series, and if Dallas goes on, Sean, to win this series, the picture of it is going to be Miro Heiskanen. And the left cheek that I think it was his left cheek, right? Just as bad of a look as you can have after a puck goes off of his face. And then he goes out and plays 31 minutes in game four.
He's an absolute beast. And you said that Seattle controlled game three, and I would argue a little bit they controlled it after Miro Heiskanen left.
Correct. They did. 100%.
Scored four goals right after he got hurt. Like, Dallas was in complete chaos. You can't take – it's like when Winnipeg lost Morrissey. Like, you just can't fix it, especially on the fly. Like, give a team a couple of days and maybe they figure it out. But on the fly, when you're trying to fill a 30-minute void of complete calmness, like, that's what it is. It's not even the skill. It's not the offense. It's the calmness. Like, he's on the ice for half the game for a reason, because he just brings a calm to that team that they can't replicate in any other way. So I think you saw his true value in the last two games, in the difference in the way that they turned out when he was hurt and when he came back. I didn't expect Seattle's goaltending to be very good. I expected Jake Ottinger to be much better than he's been. I would say, to me, that might be the most shocking thing that's happened in the second round. Even more than Toronto being behind 3-0 might be that Ottinger has not been a wall, because that's all we've ever known from him in the playoffs.
I wonder if it's too simplistic to say whoever gets better. I mean, like, if Grubauer or Ottinger, whoever plays better, will win this series. You know, their team wins the series, because you look at it, neither one of them has had a good series. I mean, they've each given up 15 goals, you know, in the four games. Grubauer's got an .875 save percentage. Ottinger's got an .860, only because he's faced 13 fewer shots than Grubauer right now. Neither one of the goalies has been good. It's been quite an offensive series, as I noted, with 8.25 goals per game. But if I had to pick one, Sean, to figure his game out and for the next, over the next two or three games, it's Ottinger for me. Like, he's the guy that I would, and there's no offense to Grubauer, but he's the guy that I would trust more to find his level of play, raise his level of play to the level that we expect from him. Whereas, like you said, you didn't expect Seattle's goaltending to be that great. In fact, Seattle won all season in spite of its goaltending a lot of times, you know, they won with their depth scoring and they're still winning with their depth scoring. That's how they are where they are in the playoffs right now. Grubauer was really good in the first round. He's kind of fallen back to the level we kind of expected him to be at in terms of, you know, averages here in the second round. Ottinger has not. Ottinger has fallen way further than we thought he would, but I have faith that he's going to pick up his game and Dallas goes and wins this series.
Well, I do too. I mean, the numbers suggest that, right? And unfortunately, when things start to go sideways in a series, it's sometimes hard to get it back, right? There's no time to practice. There's no time to work on things. And he's still a really young goalie. He's only in his third series. So that part scares me a little bit. But they're a more veteran team. I think, you know, if there's no side effects, and clearly there's not after Heiskanen played 31 minutes, you know, they're still the better, more talented team. But with all that said, what Seattle's done in these playoffs is amazing, and nobody's given it as much credit as we've given them. We haven't given them enough to kind of come into the playoffs, you know, as a wild card team, and to everybody to dismiss them. Where's the stars? Where's the goaltending? Yeah. Where's everything? Like, here it is. Like, here's the one team that's bigger than any of its individuals.
It really is. It's been that way all year. We have not, we've kind of dismissed them. Well, I don't want to say dismissed, but we've kind of kind of talked about them as like, yeah, they're there. But, you know, they can't do it. Like you said, where they start. They got 17 goal scorers in these playoffs. 17 guys with at least one goal in the playoffs. And they've played the majority, you know, of it the past, what? I mean, how many games now have they played here with Jared McCann, their 40-goal scorer, has played 5 games and he has no goals. So he's not one of the 17 that have that have a goal in the playoffs for the Seattle Kraken. And McCann's the one that scored 40 for them this season. He was the one guy who kind of broke out in that way to hit the bigger number, right? Everybody else was in the, you know, the double digits, but not really high. But this guy got the 40 and he's got none in the playoffs because he did get hurt. He came back. He came back and played game 4 against Dallas, but that would be a wild card for them, I guess, if he starts playing better and he starts feeling it and he starts heating up a little bit, maybe they, you know, figure it out and they feel as though they can get those two out of the next three here against the Dallas Stars because of that situation. But at some point, you know, like the higher end talent, Sean, just shows up. The higher end talent sometimes rises in a series that's even. We have not seen that happen, obviously, from the Toronto Maple Leafs, but that series has not been even. Okay, we haven't seen it necessarily in the Devils series either, but those are a lot of higher end talent for the New Jersey Devils are going through this for the first time. It's different, you know. Dallas is a more veteran team. Their higher end talent is pretty high. You know, you're even seeing guys like Max Domi get 3-point games right now. You know, guys have been around for a long time and they've been doing this for a long time. And in addition to Ottinger, that's another reason why I believe in Dallas to take two out of the next three.
Look, you talk about a lot of high-end talent, and I agree to an extent, but the playoffs are about north-south, right? Like, let's throw Draisaitl and McDavid out because they're on a different plane. When you look at most of the players that find success in the playoffs, it's the guys that really embrace that north-south game, that direct, I'm going to take ice that you don't want to give up. And I'm going to occupy it. Pavelski, guys like that,
yep.
Right? Like,
you right look place, at all this, right time, taking advantage of the right place, right time.
And Martinuk and all those guys, you know, we talked a little bit about him. Like, it's just that tenacious, I'm going to win every battle, and that's how I'm going to succeed. And that is the Seattle forward group to a T. There is no quote-unquote superstar, but every guy seems to revel in the cycle. And wearing teams down and going to the ugly places on the ice where you're going to pay a hellacious price to occupy that area and have an opportunity to score. That's their forward group, maybe more than any other team in the playoffs. And I think that's part of the reason why they found success.
Yeah, but you can argue the same in a way for the Dallas Stars too. Guys like Roope Hintz do that. Pavelski, clearly we know, does that. You know, Jamie Benn has done that. I think Jason Robertson deserves some credit for being that way too. So, and they're all a little bit more higher end too.
Yeah. No, and I think in the end, that's going to be the difference. But there's an understandable reason why Seattle's regular season game translated to the playoffs. It's actually, they're one of those teams that's made for the playoffs, maybe a little bit like Florida when they remade themselves, that doesn't ever really shine during the regular season because it's too long and too hard to play that way for 82 games. But when you put a 28-game sprint in front of those types of players, they're like, oh, I can do that.
Yeah.
It's not 82. I can do 28. I see the finish line. I know what the cost is, but I know what the prize is. And I'll drag myself there.
Well, we'll see. It's a good series. That's a really good series. Dallas, Seattle. So, all right, let's move on to some news and notes, Sean. I'm going to throw it in your direction. Were you surprised the New York Rangers parted ways with Gerard Gallant mutually, as they said?
Yes, mutually. No, I was not surprised. That's who Gerard Gallant's become, right, in the NHL. Every stop he's been at, it's a 2-3 year stop. He brings this immediate boost. He brings the team to a new level, and then it starts to fade a little bit, right? And we talked about this throughout the playoffs. Like, I thought that the timing of taking his team to task was completely misplaced. Because it left him no options, and it kind of, the response kind of, I think, showed management a little bit, like, what does this voice mean to the players? Like, they didn't take the bait at all.
They did not. they were arguably worse in, at times in game five after he took them to task in game four. And I believe it was game five. I'd have to double check it, but I believe it was game five is when they got outshot 20-2 in the third period. That problematic. I could be wrong on that, but they did get outshot 20-2 in the third period at some point in that series when they were down going into the third period. And that to me was a sign, right? That to me. So I was not surprised. Bigger picture here for Gerard Gallant and the Rangers. I was not surprised that they decided to go their separate ways. But here, the big question, though, is when you do that, and we brought this up, here's a guy in Gallant who won 99 games over 2 years, you know, averaged 108, 109 points, right? Got the team to the playoffs back-to-back years, played 27 playoff games, you know, coached in 27 playoff games. And I understand this was a disappointment this year, but look, all season long, the Devils were a better team than them. Okay, it was a bad matchup for them in the first round, and all season long, the Devils were a better team. But still, this was 99 wins over 2 years. When you make this decision to part ways, you got to have somebody else. Who's that else? Who's that someone else? Who's the guy, Sean? Like, that's the thing. And I think there's one guy. I could think of just one person who's absolutely perfectly fit for this job, knows New York well, understands how to coach star talent, understands the market. All of these, been in a market before, but Mike Sullivan has a job. He coaches the Pittsburgh Penguins, and he's helping find their new GM. Is Mike Sullivan eventually going to leave the Pittsburgh Penguins to go coach the New York Rangers? Because that's the guy. For me, I don't see John Cooper leaving the Tampa Bay Lightning. I don't see Jared Bednar leaving the Colorado Avalanche. But the Pittsburgh Penguins, we know they're teetering right now, right? They're teetering. It's a tougher place to win right now. If you buy into that, if you buy, you know, I mean, they're in a bit of a cap hell right now. All their star power is a year older, and they didn't make the playoffs. They haven't won since 2017, and now they haven't made the playoffs. So maybe the Penguins themselves need a new voice. We'll see. But that's the one guy, but he's got a job.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's the one guy. Well, why are you campaigning for people that have jobs to have?
I'm not campaigning. Jobs? I'm saying that's the guy I could see as a perfect fit. There could be other guys who could fit, but man, he's like exactly the type of coach that this team needs.
You know, you described the guy, all the characteristics you gave, and you said there's only one guy. There's not only one guy. There's two guys. You ever hear a coach named Joel Quenneville?
But apparently he's not coming.
Says who? You?
No, I mean, that's been the report, the rumor that it's not happening. So I'm not saying that's 100% fact. Like, we don't know. Okay. But it seems like a long shot, but so does Mike Sullivan seem like a long shot. So who knows? You know,
Mike Sullivan's a no shot.
I don't think he's a no shot. I really don't. I don't think he's a no shot. And here's why. I'll give you this. It's a little bit of a chaotic theory here. But, you know, this is what this is for. We'll throw some stuff against the wall and see what sticks, right?
No, that's not what we do. We're informed.
We are
educated. We're trying to present to our listeners facts, not complete and utter conjecture.
This is not that
chaos.
So you know that Mike Sullivan's looking. He is part of the search committee, as if you will, for the new general manager in Pittsburgh. Odd, considering he's the coach. He's kind of searching for his boss. It's a little weird. I think he's there and doing this as the hockey person for the Fenway Sports Group. They, you know, somebody who's got that tie, he's in, right? What happens if they find their guy and they maybe, you know, we know the Fenway Sports Group, you know, as a Red Sox fan, you know, they're very much into analytics, looking for like maybe that next Theo Epstein type, you know, whoever that may, could it be Kyle Dubas? We'll see. You know, that's been the talk. He's got a job too, by the way, his team's still in the playoffs, but what if Mike Sullivan, within the next, whoever the next GM is, doesn't see eye to eye with that philosophy, doesn't see eye to eye with who they eventually get, sees the team, see the direction the team is going to have to be heading in eventually, and says, I don't think this is the right place for me right now. I helped you. I did my part. We've won here. I don't think this is the right place for me right now. And he has a mutual parting of the ways with the Pittsburgh Penguins. Now he's a free agent, right? That's how the Rangers get him. It's the only way, really, that the Rangers get him. Again, it's not necessarily throwing everything against the wall here because we know he's helping out the Fenway Sports Group and finding the next GM. And we have an idea of the type of GM that they're going to be looking for. Does that mean, and we know the direction that the Penguins are going to have to eventually go here. Does that mean Mike Sullivan wants to still be there?
Dan, I have scratch paper here on my desk. It has my name on it. They're, we call them little buck slips. If this happens, I will eat one on this podcast because this is the most insane thing I've ever heard in my life. Mike Sullivan's going to take his legacy in Pittsburgh and chuck it out the window and say, I'm going to go coach another team in my division that everybody hates because that works for me.
Unlikely.
So why'd we just spend 10 minutes on it?
I'm just saying, I think I'm trying to figure out ways where he could get to the Rangers because that's the guy I think is perfect. But
why?
You know,
there's
what?
Plenty of other coaches.
There are plenty of other coaches, but there's something about the way he can coach a team. There's something about the way he can coach star players. There's something about him understanding the market as well. We've spent a lot of time on this, and it's probably not going to happen.
And what has he done since 2017? He understands all this. And he hasn't won. And that's the guy you're going to bring in. He's won less than Gerard Gallant.
And that brings me back to another point. Could this have been the wrong decision? Because the guy that you're going to look for, who the next guy is not going to be necessarily better, maybe not worse, but better than the guy you just had. Could it backfire on the Rangers? It could.
Of course it could. Every decision can. But somebody had to take the fall, and it wasn't going to be Chris Drury.
No, and I had no issue with it being Gerard Gallant.
And it wasn't going to be the players, because it's never the players. But let's move on to another big market that's going to be fascinating to watch before we get out of here. And that's the Chicago Blackhawks, who won the draft lottery, moved up a couple of spots, and they have the right now to draft Connor Bedard and change their future. Not immediately. Like, these Chicago fans that are overjoyous, like Connor Bedard's coming and here we go. The reason you have Connor Bedard is because you have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You have nothing on your team. You've traded everything away. You traded Kane away. You traded all these pieces away to not be good. Jonathan Toews most likely is going to walk away, although I wonder if the opportunity to play with the next one would be a little intriguing as a mentor. But he's not the player he once was. There is, the cupboard is bare, and now you have to rebuild with Connor McDavid, who's going to be Connor McDavid to most people. You have to make that same. You have to make the Connor McDavid journey. Right?
Yes,
like they didn't. The Edmonton Oilers all of a sudden didn't get the best player in the world as an 18-year-old, and all of a sudden they were great. The Pittsburgh Penguins didn't get the best player in the world at 18 and Sidney Crosby, and all of a sudden they were great. There's this journey that needs to be made. There's optimism in Chicago, and rightfully there should be, and I can't wait to see what Connor Bedard does in the NHL because I think he's NHL ready, but they haven't cleared the abyss at this point. They're just starting.
They're just starting. Difference with McDavid too, when he was selected in 2015, they already had Leon Draisaitl, who was selected in 2014. 100% agree with you on the Blackhawks situation right now, and every expectation needs to be tamed down. There's going to be such high expectations on Connor Bedard coming into the NHL, and that's just what happens, and I get that. But in terms of the Blackhawks themselves should expect this player to come in and be an impact player, but they need to tamper down. And I'm not saying they're raising them now, but they need to tamper down as best they can any winning expectations right off the bat, because one guy doesn't make a team. As you know, we know that, especially one 18-year-old does not make a team. What they need to do is they need to bring in, for lack of a better term, a father figure for Bedard. Remember on this very podcast when we were talking about, what about Anaheim? What if Anaheim were to get him? And Anaheim obviously gets the number two pick. You had mentioned, I think, Jonathan Toews would be perfect, right? Go there, be the mentor. I'm not sure that Jonathan Toews wants to be the mentor. I'm not sure that Jonathan Toews wants to continue playing in the National Hockey League. It would be really, really weird for Jonathan Toews to be a mentor in Chicago, where he's a legend. You know what I mean? Like, that's, it's a weird spot. I don't see it happening. I wouldn't rule it out, but I don't see it happening. But the Blackhawks need to find that guy who's going to be willing to come in and do that job. And that job also entails more than likely having Connor Bedard. We've seen it in various other places, having Connor Bedard live with you, you know, like, I mean, that's sometimes how it works. The 18-year-old living on his own in Chicago. I'm not so sure that's what the Blackhawks, the Bedards, anybody really wants. And he could be the most mature 18-year-old that there is. The fact is, he's 18, 19, whatever, right? I think Wyatt Johnson lives with Joe Pavelski in Dallas, right? I mean, it's not the same. We're not talking about the same thing. But when the Rangers drafted Kaapo Kakko, it was he lived with a billet family, essentially, you know, friends of Chris Drury, who lived in Westchester, and that's where he lived. The Blackhawks need to bring people in to this team that are going to show the way for Bedard. His talent will come out. There's no question about that. It will come out. But he's young, he's raw, and he's going to have to learn the way in a big market, in a big city, where the expectations we know will be high, even if they shouldn't be.
And that's what's going to be so fascinating about them, because your other option is to just throw them to the Wolves and you have a Clayton Keller type on your hands where, you know, there was no blueprint and he kind of had to figure it out himself, and he's become a really, really, really good player. But it took perhaps longer than it did. And let's not forget Sid, you know, had Mario, like all these guys have had players to help them. So, you know, I think for Jonathan Toews, like, that's the last chapter. To me, it would just be an unbelievable closing chapter in what's been an incredible story. But the draft, it's in the future. We still have the playoffs, some great series going on, some great drama, even in the series that aren't as competitive as we thought they were going to be. I know I'm completely riveted to my TV because I'm not in Vegas anymore. That's where you're going to be.
Yep.
And I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. But I can't wait to see how some of these series turn out and then turn our attention to the conference finals. It's going to be here before you know it.
One last thing before we get out of here that I wanted to bring up. Gabriel Landeskog, Sean. Tough news. He's going to have to have – he's having it today, I believe, the cartilage transplant in his right knee. He's going to miss another entire season. He's been a staple with the Colorado Avalanche. He's one of the really good guys in the National Hockey League. He is a Stanley Cup champion. And so I just wanted to say that I hope, because I love the way he plays, I hope he can come back and be even half the player that he was and get back to the NHL, because that was brutal to see that news that he's going to miss another season. And Mark Mathot on Twitter, by the way, former defenseman in the NHL, Mark Mathot said he had that surgery and he never could quite come back to play in the NHL.
Yeah, well, look, it's going to be tough, but I think anybody that can, like, it's Landeskog. He's so much, not that Mark isn't tough. Mark's one of the toughest players ever to play in this league, but Gabriel is so mentally strong. And yeah, if his body will half agree with him or cooperate with him, you know, I think we'll see him back and playing, but who knows? But it was a brutal blow and they missed him more than maybe even I thought in the playoffs. And you just hope the best for him. I mean, you see these players and their careers are cut short because of injury. I immediately think of, you know, in Colorado, Peter Forsberg, same thing, you know, with the foot injuries that he had and his inability to ever come back and be the player he once was. So again, you know, we'll see. That's in the long, long-term future, because he's not going to play again until 04, 05.
04, 24, 25.
24, 25.
You're going backwards.
Yeah, well, it's a time machine. Again, like I said, I can't wait to see how some of these series turn out. And the last thing I'll say to you before we get out of here is awards are going on as well. We're getting the final threes for a lot of these awards, and those debates can start, and those are debates we'll have on here in the next few weeks, I'm sure. I can't wait to have the MVP debate with you again.
Oh, man, I can wait. I don't like it anymore. We'll have it eventually. They did announce the Masterton yesterday. That's Clayton Keller, Chris Letang, and Alex Stalock. Always an interesting one to follow, that Masterton award, Masterton trophy. But like you said, Sean, lots of hockey still to be played. By this time next week, we'll probably be talking about the conference final. Who's going to win? Who's going to stay in? Where do the Leafs go from here if they do get eliminated, unless they come back and make history? Lots going on in the hockey world, on and off the ice. Games coming at you fast and furious. Enjoy the hockey.